Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Rodriguez, a PhD candidate in history at Vanderbilt University and a host on the network. Today, I'll talk to Paul Jankowski about his new book, All Against All, The Long Winter of 1933 and the Origins of the Second World War. Jankowski is the Raymond Ginger Professor of History at Brandeis University and the author of four previous monographs on topics ranging from the history of political scandals in France to the myths that have informed popular memory of battles of the First World War. In this latest monograph, Professor Jankowski provides a wide-angled account of a critical period of world history in which the world transitioned from the post-war to the pre-war and saw the disintegration of collective security and international institutions created after the First World War. Drawing on international history's methodology of multi-archival research, Jankowski constructs an elegantly written and deeply researched narrative history of this decline, by looking at both high-level diplomacy and the changing popular mentalities that influence many of the decisions of policymakers. Professor Jankowski, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. And thank you for that introduction.
My pleasure. I'd like to start by asking you about your training as a scholar and how your training has shaped your approach to writing about this period that you explore in the book. And I'd also like to ask, considering this is your fifth monograph, if I'm not mistaken, I'm also wondering how you view this book, this latest book, fitting in to some of your earlier work. Are there a set of themes or preoccupations that you think run across your work?
Well, I don't know. Actually, it's an interesting question and a rare opportunity to talk about myself, which is very to be valued. First part of your question was about whether my training as a scholar has survived into this latter day project. And I don't know, my training as a scholar, this is at Oxford, but I've spent all my time in France in the archives working on the 1930s and the Second World War and about collaborationist movements in the in southern France, one in particular. And of course, the Oxford in those days, it may have changed since, was hostile to any to the broad brush approach. This really was a matter, it was deeply empirical. Getting into the archives of a place and a time and really immersing oneself in it before one even knew what one wanted to do with it. Now, the book that you so nicely described is hardly about that. It's really very broad brush. It looks at great number of countries in the world in narrow time span, 1932 to 1933, and necessarily foregoes any in-depth look at any single one of them. So in that sense, it's about as different as could be from what I was trained to do. But in another sense, maybe a rather abstract one, it's not. I think most of my work has been not about the economic forces that shape some particular era or event, or about the interests in play, or about the power game or the cultural significance or whatever, but about collective beliefs that drove the events of the time. And in that sense, I was working on that in my first book about Marseille, and I'm working about that now. I've tried to look at the ways in which, in the early 30s, countries turned away from each other. And I try to show that collective beliefs had a lot to do with this, or collective sentiments. So in that sense, perhaps I'm still in the same, playing with the same fire. I don't know if that's too abstract. We can pursue that, or
That's very helpful. I mean, the collective beliefs part is very interesting to me. I mean, obviously, it has its roots in the Annales school, but the kind of successive generations of the Annales school have taken very different approaches to the history of mentalities, I guess would be the term. But I don't know, to what extent do you see yourself in dialogue with that work or using that methodology, or do you think you're doing something, so what you're doing an offshoot, but is distinct from that, or do you find that work appealing, or has it influenced your approach in your work?
I do find much of the work of the analysts appealing, very much so, especially the ones you mentioned, the historians of mentality. And in that sense, some of the early analysts, including Marc Bloch and Lucien Febvre, were already dealing with that. And then by the 1960s, people like Robert Mandrou and others were, a little bit later than that, Michel Vauvel, were indeed looking at what they called mentalité. The difference, I think, is that they were either medievalists or especially early modern historians. And that really is a different world from the one I'm dealing with. They often had to disinter mentalities from the traces it left, as the holders of those beliefs or the of those attitudes were often illiterate. They'd work on wills, but those wills were dictated, and so on. I'm dealing with a much more consciously articulated set of beliefs and attitudes, not found in public opinion polls, because we don't have those yet for this period. And even those are extremely treacherous. They're very difficult to use. But in the vehicles of public expression, the press, among others. So I think it would be far-fetched to really represent this as an attempt to transport the historians of mentalities and out style into 20th century history, however flattering that that suggestion is to me. In some ways, I'd never really attempted to place this in any formal historiographical school. Indeed, in some ways, this book is intended for a more general audience than that of professional historical scholars. And in that sense, I don't know that I can identify it with a single historiographical doctrine or practice. But I can certainly talk, if you like, at some point, about how I've written this and what I have tried to do, whichever school it might belong to.
Well, this leads perfectly into the next question I want to ask, which is about your decision to structure this as a narrative history. And I found it, this particular narrative format, in which you pair foreign cities together, very engaging, but also analytically very powerful. And the structure of the book, the way it jumps from city to city and it juxtaposes cities, does a lot. I mean, just the structure itself provides quite a lot of analytical payoff, it seems to me. And I'm wondering if you initially envisioned this project as having a narrative structure, or was this something that organically developed through the research project? And just a last part of that question is, what are your larger thoughts on narrative history, the advantages of narrative history, and perhaps the disadvantages? And are we seeing a kind of comeback of narrative history in the past decade or so, let's say?
I'll start with the first part of the question. Did I envisage this as a narrative history to begin with?
Yeah.
I suppose so, but I would slightly qualify the description. It's narrative and descriptive. In that sense, I hoped and tried to. As I've actually tried to do this in earlier work, I don't know if it worked or not, but I've tried again to present a narrative description that is itself an argument. And if you can show something happening, if you can show, in this case, the leaders, say the American president, bowing to public pressures not to get too involved in European affairs, or if you can show some of the popular roots of Japanese militarism, or the appeal it might have had, and where, I suppose narrating it, you're also making a statement about it. And in that sense, what I'm trying to do, to come back to the earlier question you asked, is actually very, very old-fashioned in that we in the historical profession today and graduate school and in the graduate seminars we have for at least 50 years now fallen completely under the sway of the social science model, haven't we? I would say we are told to present an argument, marshal the sources, describe the methods as we go along, repeat the argument at each stage of the way as it develops, and repeat it again lest the reader miss it, then conclude it, repeat it, and summarize it at the end. At the beginning, we are asked to situate it with respect to existing historical literature. This is a social science approach. We have been doing this for many decades now. To actually present something as a story is very suspiciously like popular history, and therefore very unpopular within the academy. Now, I think that can be moderated, that taboo. You'll find many, many historians today who dislike it. I don't think it's coffee table history. And for that reason, for a very long time, military history was taboo in the academy. It didn't have to be written that way, in fact. And many of us didn't. But that taboo came into play. So I felt that with all that was going on in this narrow time frame of about 1 year, from 1932 to 1933, if I could show simultaneous developments taking place, as you say, in different parts of the world, and make it as clear as I possibly could what the parallels between them were, without actually beating the reader over the head every stage of the way explaining what I was doing, I might produce a book that was not only valuable, but also readable. Now, it's up to the reader to say whether it works or not. But I still have a certain hankering for the great 19th century historians. When I speak of telling and showing, narrating and showing, Those are quintessentially literary approaches. And in the 19th century, to write history was to write literature. Now, of course, the great ones, the Michelets and so on, the problem was what kind of sources did they use? What evidence did they have for what they were writing? But I would like to think that we can use the methods of 21st century scholarship, the archival methods, the source base, and combine it with some very modest literary approaches to produce a work that is accessible to a wider readership while losing none of the academic rigor that's gone into producing it.
I think it's very successful at that. And just on this kind of note of the taboo nature of narrative history for many in the historical profession and the way popular history is criticized. I mean, you do quite an interesting thing at the beginning, in the very beginning of the book, which is you do the opposite of what a lot of academics who end up writing trade press books do. Is you make the, you show that the you're skeptical of the claim that the period you're studying here in the interwar years was very similar to today. And for you, the difference was that the way that the way that mass politics, to quote here, eventually came to work against any international engagements other than the most transparently and immediately self-serving. Is that the core of the kind of argument you're trying to make, and the way is that the goal also of these chapters, the way you've sequenced the chapters to show how this happened?
That's an important part of it. Yes, I mean I tried to show in this book that in the in this period, before we really got to the appeasement of the later 1930s and the crises of the later 30s. Something was going on that wasn't that would last, and that was the fragmentation, nations turning their backs on each other, the inward turn. And I wanted to show, when I say nations, I mean a certain number of nations, those that would be most directly involved in the outbreak of the Second World War some years later. Why so many others are left out is another matter. And I wanted to go on to show that that wasn't just the work of a few statesmen playing chess on the world chessboard, or of diplomatic policies and even of economic necessities, although that was important, that there was indeed a climate of domestic belief of which they were a part. So I did want to show that. Now the question of what it has to do with today, is that something that
I ended up merging two questions together, but my point was, is that, and the question that it leads to is that a lot of books that are intended for a popular audience that are about a topic that seems to have something to do with the present moment really try to exploit that. And they end up telling a story showing that the past was not so different. Yes. But you're saying that the past, in fact, was different. There are different set of conditions involved. Certainly, there are some parallels, but you're not making this kind of argument that the past is more similar than we think it was, which I appreciate, and showing that the past, yes, the past is quite different from the present moment. So,
I am. Well, I think it is. I wouldn't be the only one warn against drawing these parallels. It's one of the deep divisions between political scientists and historians that we're very, very reluctant to make them. On the other hand, you're quite right. Historians do sometimes like to show that whatever it is they're going to write about in the book that follows, it does have some parallel with today. I mean, it sounds like today in some way. That may be a device. It may also please a publisher. And sometimes it's not altogether untrue. Although, as you, I think, say, we have to be extremely careful about it. I was always rather skeptical about the many of the parallels that were drawn over the past 10 years or so between the rise of populist authoritarian dictators or heads of state or government, nationalist populist authoritarian leaders today and those of the 30s. It's something that you can, I certainly don't blame people for drawing, but we have to be very careful that we don't lose more by calling Trump Hitler than we gain. Those parallels are difficult to make, but I do think with respect to the 30s and today, there is one that I think does bear some. It is not altogether meaningless. And that is this question of this process of national fragmentation. Or to put it a little differently, as we're talking about the present, this year, the last spring and summer, the demonstrations and popular protests that broke out about racial inequality and racial violence and injustice in the U.S. Broke out all over the world. In Latin America, in South Africa, and so on, in Europe. And yet they were breaking out just as the world was continuing to fragment, as tariffs were being raised, neighbors were invading each other in some parts of the world, barriers, borders were being closed to keep out COVID. So there is this tension between transnational causes, which one was racial inequality, it was a big one, and international fragmentation, transnational causes flourishing just as nations are turning their backs on one another. Now, there I think one can draw a parallel with what I'm trying to write about with the early 30s. So, and I quite agree with you about being very hesitant at first to draw such parallels. But there, I think there is something. These transnational enthusiasms abounded in the early 30s. Pacifism was one. I read about the disarmament conference in Geneva that opened in February 1932. At its openings, people from all over the world came bearing petitions from organizations that were said to represent some 200 million people. Revolutionary communism was another. New York, I suppose mostly intellectuals, but communists, the writers and others, believers in the cause, used to leave each other saying, meet me on the barricades. World government was another. In Britain, the League of Nations Union had 400,000 members. This was the peak of all those enthusiasms, and yet it was also the moment that as I'm saying a minute ago, we're writing about, the moment of national fragmentation and of beggar thy neighbor, every man for himself, and the devil take the hindmost. And it seemed to me that that parallel was too interesting to ignore. So sometimes, yes, I think it can be done.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's done with with great discretion throughout. But I want to get back to something that we've been talking around a bit, but it's very important for the book, which is the idea of popular opinion, or public opinion, or international opinion, all these variations. And this something you talk about, I think, in almost every chapter. And I wanted to ask two sort of smaller questions. One is that first of all, let's, at the level, a lot of people, intellectual historians, have looked at the idea of public opinion polling in a later era. But at this point, I'm wondering how your historical actors are conceiving of, if they are, self-consciously, the idea of public opinion, and how, if that's the case, how that constrained or perhaps opened up certain opportunities for them in their kind of maneuvering at kind of a high level of diplomacy. So on the one hand, how I'm interested in how you're using it as a concept, but also how your actors are conceiving of it and how it either limited or opened up options for them.
Well, that's a critical theme you're raising. And public opinion is, as you hinted, as you were, I think, indicating, is the most incredible can of worms for anyone trying to deal with it, whether in, say, the late 18th century revolutionary France or revolutionary Latin America, or mid 20th century Europe or wherever. It depends on whether we have which public, who speaks for whom, what sources, do we have polls? Does public opinion exist before there were polls, or do polls invent it, and so on? I can't answer all those questions, but I in this book, to return to the question you're raising, I think it helps in these various countries I'm writing about to distinguish between public sentiment and public opinion. It is clear, I think, to take an example, that in Britain in the early 30s, public sentiment was overwhelmingly pacific. It was unwarlike. I know there are many, many different forms of pacifism, but that word means many different things. But the sentiment was avoid war. Then that was a very strong sentiment. On the other hand, doing so by disarming, as opposed to doing so by deterring, there we're entering the realm of opinion, of public opinion. And public sentiment could be pacifist, but public opinion could be against disarmament, or one part of it could be. So public opinion is a more articulated form of public sentiment when it is placed before a particular policy or a particular problem. And I think that governments were coming to understand that distinction here and there, which is the second part of your question. And to stick with this example, the British government knew this. It knew it really, since I'll return to the question of disarmament, but we could pursue this in other ways. Isolationism in America, for example, what that might mean, if it still means anything. But the government, by taking part really very actively in the disarmament process at Geneva, was heeding that public sentiment. At the same time, by not going too far, by not giving away too much, it was heeding one part of public opinion, which particularly conservative, but well, it was mixed up between right and left. By pursuing the cause of disarmament in Geneva and actively seeking some type of international agreement, the government was heeding one kind of public sentiment, but while being very careful about what it would do there, whether it would abolish military aviation, for example, or how far it would go in making concessions to the Germans and so on. There, it was heeding different forms of public opinion. And that public opinion, again, we don't have polls, and it may even be a good thing. I wouldn't go so far as the French sociologist who said public opinion doesn't exist. But the that kind of public opinion, we can indeed, in countries where such a press exists, start to study it in an articulated form in different opinion organs and different newspapers, different columns and editorials and publications and speeches and so on. And that is not necessarily, when you call that public opinion or popular opinion, you're not saying that it represents the conscious attitudes of the great masses of those who may have read these papers, but it represents it at that intermediate level. Does that any of that make any?
Yeah, no, I think that's very helpful. I mean, and I'm also thinking, and I wonder if you have thoughts on this, but my sense is that of some intellectuals at the time, particularly I'm thinking of a very famous book, I think that sold quite well in the late 20s, Ortega y Gasset's The Rebellion of the Masses.
Yes.
And his diagnosis of the problem of modern society being the mass man. I'd imagine that that does factor in here, and I'd imagine that some of the historical actors you're looking at, although they're not necessarily intellectuals, or some of them I guess are as well, but is this something, a concept that is informing many of the discussions, this fear of the masses and I guess the larger crisis of the modern era would be the underlying thing if we're to take Ortega y Gasset's line.
Fear. Well, let's say, can we awareness of masses? I think very definitely, and I and to a certain extent, Ortega y Gasset was a philosopher, of course, but that's a very important book, even if some have called it Nietzsche light, because of the for some obvious reasons, but the. I think the question you raise is relevant. Governments were aware of mass opinion. They knew it mattered. And this was the case in all kinds of very, very different regimes and societies. I don't think anyone was more aware of it, for example, than Joseph Stalin. He was daily trying to shape mass opinion. He was daily trying to answer it. But at the same time, when you see the evolution of Franklin Roosevelt from the 20s to the 30s, from his ardent support for the League of Nations and American activism abroad in 1920, to his growing silence over the 1920s, and then his complete, really, his near passivity towards at least Europe, not Latin America, but at least Europe, it is very difficult not to think that he is acutely aware of where he thought American mass opinion was drifting. Is that the kind of phenomenon that you're asking about when we talk about the mass?
Yeah. I guess I'm seeing. I guess I'm asking. Really, so is the mass man or the masses? Are they seen as both a political opportunity and also a huge threat? That if the masses have too much say or influence over world diplomacy, then that presents risk, and not just world diplomacy, but especially in the national context that you look at, but the masses, if one could get a sense of what they want and anticipate it, is able to actually use this to one's advantage as a politician, perhaps.
Yes, I think this has been happening certainly since the 19th century. since we're talking about international relations here, which I suppose in the conventional sense are really treated as, well, until recently, this has changed, as the relations between states, between governments, advent of democracy, by which I mean mass participation in government and the state, whether it's a liberal or illiberal democracy, necessarily transformed the nature of international relations. If we want to study the attempts to deal, for example, with Hitler once he came to power, if you want to understand appeasement, I think it does help to see the government as being attentive to what it thought opinion at home wanted or would take or would approve of, in a way that it would not have, for example, in the 18th century. It's not that it never mattered before. I mean, there were crowds in the Seven Years' War in Paris, for example, that had very strong views on what was happening. But as a constant and sometimes determining force, I think this is a product of 19th and 20th century history. For the most part, I find it very difficult to deny that in any way. Certainly, in the First World War. Now, I think there was another part to your question. It was whether they sought to exploit it or whether they thought to whether they feared it.
Yeah,
I think clearly both of those are would be correct, and the historian needs to explore them. Yeah. But we can see this even in attempting to influence the mass opinion of the other, the potential adversary or the potential ally, before the First World War, paying quite a lot of attention to the daily newspapers of the other. This is a sign of that new reality the new reality that you've raised.
Yeah,
and of course, it didn't stop when the war broke out. It continued. The Germans trying to suborn French newspapers and so on.
Well, since you mentioned newspapers, I thought this might be a good time to just talk about your methodological approach, or specifically the archival work you did for this project. In many chapters, I mean, you're working directly in the archives, but also in some cases you are reading, reports from archives that are reporting on world newspapers. And I guess that's partially how you get at the public opinion part. But could you just talk a little bit about what it was like to do the archival work for this book and maybe some challenges that it presented given its scope?
Yes, that was a problem for me because to distinguish between archival, that is to say, unpublished material, and published material, I was limited by languages. I mean, I could handle the European, French, German, Italian, and so on, but Japanese and Russian are a real problem for me. But when using diplomatic archives, what I tried to do was to get at the reports that embassies and consulates sent to their home governments about what they thought was going on. As you probably know, a lot of these diplomatic archives are published in massive series. The foreign relations of the U.S., the French diplomatic archives, the British, and so on. Mm. But those are selective. They don't publish everything. Read the archives from some of the American consulates in Germany, read the records there, the messages they sent, or from, say, the American legation in Latvia, which was covering the Soviet Union until diplomatic relations were restored. This is very valuable. The most valuable of all I found in that respect were the French, for, say, the countries of Eastern Europe, Hungary, for example, I would have found it difficult to, without a research assistant, master a lot of the Hungarian material. But often what the French embassy was saying, the way it was analyzing events frequently on a day-by-day basis, was very, very useful to me. Obviously, on its own, I sometimes had to check this, but I always did. I was able to use some help for Russian material. So I used diplomatic sources in that way, and I think that's somewhat different in that most diplomatic archives traditionally have been used to study to narrate the history of intergovernmental relations. This time I was using them to unearth daily realities of life in the countries to which these diplomats were posted. The other part, I think, to the question was about the press. Yes, how did I? Well, I can't read the Japanese press, but there you're correct. I was using, this was again from the French archives. They had, for 1932 and 33, a very, very detailed summary, day by day, of the Japanese press and what the different newspapers were saying. And once I've familiarized myself with the Japanese press, about which particular interest group or sector of opinion this or that newspaper represented, it was very valuable to read the French daily summaries, which were frequently translations of editorials and that sort of thing. In countries like the Soviet Union or Fascist Italy, obviously we're not dealing with anything like a free press. But it still has a use all its own. You can decode official propaganda. You can see what they're not talking about, the shift in tone, what they are, and also you can discern what they want their own people to believe. So this is a somewhat different use of it. There, when I couldn't read the Russian press, I used weekly summaries of it from diplomatic archives, again, including the French, but there were some others as well. So I don't know. Those are some of the ways that I used these materials. Those are all primary sources. That's true. Mm-hmm. Some published in the press, obviously published. Mm-hmm. Some unpublished in the press, clearly published.
Well, that's very helpful. I mean, just in terms of, you know, for thinking about, you know, the real challenges one is presented with when trying to write an international history or a transnational history. You're limited, of course, firstly by languages, and then perhaps the geographical burden of having to go to so many archives. But I mean, in your case, it seems that it was quite feasible to have the richness of the French archives, and having the things translated made this possible. And otherwise, perhaps it would have been quite, it indeed is an undertaking already, but would have been almost impossible to just based on the travel and the mastery of so many different language families, which very few people can do. So,
And in the case of the French, the reason they had such good people in Eastern Europe is because these countries mattered a great deal to them at that time. Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Romania, Yugoslavia, they paid a lot of attention to them. So in that sense, I was fortunate. I won't dwell on this, but some of the American material from Japan I found very, very interesting, including the State Department archives, of course, but also the military intelligence, which reported quite extensively on Japanese politics. Those are sitting in College Park in Maryland. I don't know if you've used these and these kinds of things in your work on Latin America. I expect you have.
Some of them. But this is also helpful to look out for these types of sources in the future. We are coming up on our last few minutes, so I wanted to just end by asking you about You've finished the book, or the book has just been published, and what are you working on currently? Have you moved on to a project that directly relates, or are you moving in a different direction for the next book or project?
Yeah, I don't have a definite project in mind, but when I wrote this book, I was thinking of this as part of a continuing study of how the world descended into chaos in the 1930s. And I was very taken with the idea of choosing a narrow time frame, in this case, 32 to 33, because to come back to one of your earlier questions, it allowed for effective narration and description. The more stretched the time frame, the more abstract the treatment becomes necessarily. If you have a narrow time frame, you have real people in real places. And the other aspect was the simultaneity, show things going on simultaneously. And I thought that perhaps something like that for later in the 30s, showing what had happened by then, might be possible, building on what I had learned about the beginning of the decade. So I'm still thinking about that. I don't know if it's a good idea or not. I certainly don't want to do the same thing all over again. But in what happened in the early 30s, the war was not yet inevitable. It was not a dead certainty by any means. By the late 30s, it was. So something has changed. And if I can use some of the same themes and not retell the story which has already been told about about Hitler and about appeasement and about the how the Japanese got themselves involved in a disastrous war in China and so on, then maybe there'd be something there. So I'm still sort of toying with that. I don't know, but I should ask someone, including you, if you ever have any thoughts about this. Tell me what.
I would agree, this is such a fertile area for scholarship, and there's so many different directions one could take it. It seems to me that it would warrant a further exploration. And I do like this this technique of focusing on a short time period, and I think it allows for the kind of level of detail and in terms of the way you describe things in the book and the focusing on specific events, that it allows for that possibility where focusing on a larger time frame might be impossible to do such a thing.
Yes, I know we're running out of time. I just wanted to add about that narrow time frame, a broad geographical spectrum, but this book is in no way, the one we've been talking about, is in no way a history of the world in 1932. 33, because half the world is left out.
Yeah,
the southern half. It's really about a particular. It's already in a way rather selective, in that it looks at countries that were directly involved in the outbreak of the war later on. And in that sense, that left me not really spending a lot of time on, say, Britain's dominions or Britain's British Empire, or in Latin America, of course, which was actually quite actively involved in the League of Nations. But it becomes two, or some Latin American countries. If I were to do this for later in the 30s, I think that would change, because by then I think we have be the same cast of characters. They might be joined by some others. But it still is not meant to be world history in that sense. I know that world history does not necessarily mean history of the world, but this certainly is not that.
Well, in any case, I think look forward to reading whatever you end up deciding on to focus on in your next project. But let me just thank you for talking. I think this is a really fascinating conversation, and I enjoyed learning about the writing process behind the book and some of your methodological choices and all the rest.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for doing this. It's been very enjoyable.